This is a YUN interview with Dr. Tant Mint Wu in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I'm sorry, in Cambridge, England, on July the 1st, 1998, regarding Cambodia. The interviewer is Sutherland. So, and Dr. Mintu, I wanted first of all to thank you for agreeing to participate in this Yale Oral History Project. And in discussing your experiences in Cambodia, I'd like to begin to ask you to put on the record, so to speak, what was your background before you were assigned or before you took the position that you did hold in the Cambodian project program?
I was at that time a PhD candidate at Cambridge University, having completed my undergraduate degree at Harvard a few years ago and my master's degree at Johns Hopkins a couple of years before. I had worked for the UN on a very short project once at UNBRA, the UN Border Relief Operation on the Thai-Cambodian border, and I had worked on the Burmese-Thai border with Burmese refugees, and I'd also worked as a consultant for Asia Watch, which is my main human rights background up until that point.
So did you volunteer for this, or were you were not actually then a secretary?
No, I was not a member of the UN at that time. I was interested in going out to Cambodia, perhaps joining the UN in some other role, and I'd approached different people and wound up with that particular job.
And how were you selected? Do you know, I mean, was this a matter of putting in an application?
Yes, I'd applied formally, and I got in direct contact with Dennis McNamara, who was director of human rights at that time already, through a common professional acquaintance of ours. And I'm not sure exactly how the selection process worked, but a couple of months after I put in my formal application, I was offered a post as a human rights officer.
And was that what you were particularly interested in the human rights area?
Yes, I wanted to work specifically with Dennis McNamara.
And was there any prior training process that you went through in order to be oriented as to what the human rights situation
was? Not before I arrived in Cambodia. I mean, I took it upon myself to read different books about Cambodia and about the situation. I knew something about it before, having worked on the border. But it was only when we arrived in Phnom Penh that there was about a week or 10-day long orientation process, which involved mainly orienting ourselves within the mission administratively and things, and only to some extent orienting ourselves with regards to the country's own.
And when did you arrive?
I arrived in June of 1992, originally on a six-month contract, but then stayed through most of September 1993.
So that was really just a few months after UNTAC was established?
It was still in the middle of being established. I think I arrived more or less at the same time as most of the people. So I would say a third to half of the people wanted to join the line.
And how would you describe your assigned duty? What was your job?
It was all, I arrived when it was still a fairly fluid situation. I was appointed as a human rights officer. I told Dennis that I'd like to remain in Phnom Penh if possible. I was first made an information officer within the human rights component and did that for about 6 weeks. And then Dennis took me on as his assistant. So for the vast majority of my time in Cambodia, I was Dennis's assistant and worked with him closely on pretty much everything he did. I was also in charge of, to varying extents, of the paper flow within the office, managing correspondence and things for him. But I also went with him to all the various meetings, wrote up the reports from those meetings, drafted both internal and external reports of the component. And I was also in charge of sort of our informal liaison with NGOs and with the press.
So you spent most of your time in Phnom Penh?
I traveled when Dennis traveled. I traveled occasionally on my own because we were a small component. We all did bits and pieces of everything. But yes, the vast majority of my time was in Phnom Penh.
Now, what was the relationship of this office to the civil administration segment of Phnom Penh?
In theory or in...
No, in reality. Well, both, in theory and reality. In theory, as I understand, civil administration was more or less in charge.
Well, civil administration had a very had their role of controlling key areas of government in the run-up to the election to ensure that the election was free and fair. We had a broad human rights mandate, an extremely broad human rights mandate, in the sense that we, under the Paris Peace Agreements, all the parties undertook to ensure that severe human rights abuses never occurred again, and it was the role of our component to help them in implementing those commitments. So there was an overlap between our work and civil affairs, in the sense that they were trying to control key areas of government of the various factions in order that free and fair elections could be held, meaning that there needed to be at least a decent standard of human rights or respect for human rights by the various Cambodian factions. Of course, we wanted that as well, so that was the area of overlap. But we also took a much longer term view, because we were because our mandate in some way stretched beyond the civil administration's mandate, in that we were looking also at the post-election situation.
And how would you describe, I mean, there have been some criticism of the civil administration segment. How would you describe your relations with that?
Well, I suppose it depended on the issues. If one had to take a very general view, I think we, or some of us in the component, thought that civil administration was being too conservative. Looking at things from a human rights perspective, I think we wanted them to take stronger action in controlling, or take a harder line in controlling areas of government, especially the state of Cambodia, which had, of course, the main state apparatus in Cambodia at that time. And to take a stronger line in redressing human rights problems. So on many given issues or problems, we would be advocating a fairly strong human rights redress action, whereas often they would be wary, for various reasons, of not taking a very strong action. I think probably for fear of jeopardizing a more general relationship with the state Cambodian authorities.
And what about with Mr. Akashi, the special representative? There has been some criticism of the reportedly very centralized procedures that he followed. How did the human rights section fare under this administration?
Well, I didn't know Mr. Akashi very well at that time. I met him and knew him much better later on. I think we were eager to make a pitch early in our time, UNTAC's time in Cambodia, that human rights should be a very central part of the whole operation and not seen as something that was sort of done on the side and very much peripheral to the main work of elections and the repatriation of refugees. And I'm not quite sure what Mr. Akashi's ideas on that were, but I think we always had a feeling of being outsiders or peripheral to the mission, always trying to make, continually having to try to make a case for strong human rights action throughout that period. And I think there were certain specific instances in which we were frustrated and we wished that there was more backing from the top, from both from Mr. Akashi's office and from other components. But I think there was more of a central problem in the whole structure of the mission and the peace agreement, in that there was all this language about the need to improve human rights, but yet there wasn't an inbuilt redress mechanism. So every time there was a problem, the whole the response of UNTAC had to be negotiated. And in that whole process of negotiation, it took a lot of time, and that in itself made it that much less effective. So I think there was a very central problem which went beyond sort of individual decisions that were taken and had to do with the way in which the whole mission was conceived and set up.
And the appointment of the prosecutor, did that help?
Well, that came quite late on. I think we were faced with the situation by, say, January, February of 1993, with the election only a few months away, of mounting political violence on the one hand by the state of Cambodia authorities against perceived political opponents, and also by the Khmer Rouge, the National Army of Democratic Cambodia, against ethnic Vietnamese in their effort to to galvanize popular opinion behind them. And it was very unclear what redress mechanisms that we had, which were built into the agreement, which we could use to try to change this. The special prosecutor office was set up as an attempt to do this. We weren't particularly optimistic that that would happen, but we felt that something had to be tried. We felt this was a way of both trying to tackle this problem of rising political violence, and also we thought that the special prosecutor's office could be a way of jump-starting our attempts to revive the Cambodian judiciary as well.
Yes, because any action had to be taken within the framework of the Cambodian judiciary, is that true?
Not necessarily. I mean, that was a matter of debate. There were two possible approaches we could have taken. We could have arrested people under the authority which we had, which we believed we had in the agreement, and then prosecuted them through a tribunal which we had, which we would have then set up, which would have been perhaps part foreign, part Cambodian, but it would have been a UN-established tribunal. The other way, which is the course that we eventually did take, was to try to prosecute these people through the Cambodian courts. I think a lot of people thought, or some people thought at that time, that setting up a foreign tribunal would have been too heavy-handed, or too interventionist. And also, some people felt that trying to prosecute them through the Cambodian judicial system would have helped the Cambodian judicial system at this very critical time in trying to resuscitate some security of independence for them.
In that connection, Mr. Akashi has emphasized that he considered it important in judging questions of human rights to understand what were considered human rights violations within the culture of the region, not just Cambodia, but other regions. Yeah. Was this something that permeated your work, Dennis McNamara's work? Were you aware of this? How?
Yes, very much so. And I think the important thing was to, or I would have argued, and I think I did argue, and other people did argue, and I think Dennis would probably argue, that the most important thing was to make our human rights work relevant to the context in which we were working, and to try to promote and protect human rights, to explain these things in a language which people in Cambodia would understand. What I would disagree with is that in some way, the kinds of human rights that we were trying to promote and protect were alien to that local context. I think, on the contrary, I think what we found in Cambodia was a society which was so devastated because of its recent history, because of what had happened under the Khmer Rouge, because of the following years of civil war and foreign occupation. A society which was so devastated that many of the people there very much welcomed and wanted new ideas and new approaches and new thoughts about how to structure their society and government. There was not a single case that I remember of a Cambodian person in a town or a village in Phnom Penh ever saying, oh, this is alien to us, we don't want it. On the contrary, everyone was saying, you know, help us and let us and give us some new approaches to building our country. So in that way, that was a more cultural or locally relevant aspect that we need to keep in mind, how fluid ideas and structures were in this country. Of course, in terms of language, that's another issue. I mean, I think people, as a Buddhist country, as a predominantly Buddhist country, as a country with its own sort of political background, it was important to try to understand the local language, not just in a narrow sense, but in a broader sense, and pitch human rights in that language. And that's very difficult to do. Very few of us were Khmer speakers. We didn't have the resources to do that. That would have been a much longer-term project. And so I think because of that, we made a decision, and Dennis and others made a decision, to try to work with local Cambodian partners as much as possible, so that it wouldn't be our necessarily rest entirely on our shoulders to try to bridge this cultural gap.
You mean local NGOs?
local NGOs, Cambodian human rights groups that had developed at that time in particular. Yeah.
And did you find that these local groups, which had to be fairly new, were they relatively sophisticated? Were they familiar with the Universal Declaration, for example?
Well, the people at the top were. In general, the quality was very mixed. I mean, there were people who actually had some sort of background in human rights, and some of them were Cambodians who had lived abroad for a number of years before returning home. And of course, they were sophisticated. They had a very good idea about what we were trying to do and what the UN, the human rights mechanisms were. But then there were many people who joined recently, really had very little idea, had a lot of good intentions, but needed information, needed training, and so we saw our role as and part as providing that sort of information.
And you were able to do that. You were able to do the training of the indigenous.
We were actually, in that way, we were actually quite successful, I think, at reaching out to a huge number of people. I don't remember the numbers offhand now, but it was in the hundreds of thousands, the number of the people that we actually either personally spoke to through, you know, sort of open air lectures, meetings, showing videos, through programs we did on Cambodian television and radio. We had mobile teams of people who went around with video screens who then took questions afterwards. It was a very sort of grassroots campaign which we did in conjunction with the various Cambodian human rights organizations. That, you know, admittedly that was over a 6 month or 9 month period. But I think in the end, a sizable minority of the population actually had some sort of contact with UN human rights information program.
What communication facilities did you have to reach out to the public?
It was, well, I think UN radio and UN television were extremely important, not just for human rights, but in general, in trying to create a slightly different environment in which free and fair elections could be held. But we also had a lot of these mobile teams using audiovisual equipment and going out to groups of 50, 100, 30, whatever, of different sizes and speaking to them in person as well.
Now, were radios everywhere available or not?
They weren't everywhere available, but I think, as I remember, there were someone had funded some sort of scheme in which radios were distributed.
The Japanese
distributed throughout the country. Wow. And I know that at least in the urban area, in Phnom Penh, in a few of the larger cities, that UN television and UN human rights television and radio programs had an effect. I remember one case, for example, in Phnom Penh, towards the end of the time, around the time of the elections, where a man on the street in Phnom Penh had hit another man in a car accident, and a crowd had gathered, as happens there, and they started attacking the man that they thought was responsible for the accident. At which point, a group of university students came through and said, "You know, no, this is a violation of this man's human rights. These are the human rights which have been violated. This is what we had heard on television and radio. We need to take him to the police station first," and managed to escort this man out. I mean, that's just one example, which, you know, I saw myself, but I think there were a few others like that. So, it, however ephemeral, it did have a certain impact at that time.
And what about the external NGOs? Were they active in the human rights field? Did you have, what was your relationship with them?
Well, I think the difficulty in a way was that while there was a number of different international human rights organizations, very few of them, or none of them actually, had ever worked in a peacekeeping environment. Their experience very much been monitoring situations in foreign countries and writing reports and lobbying and all that, but had very little experience, and the UN had very little experience in actually being part of an operation on the ground. And so we encouraged them, or we tried to encourage them to work with us, and a number of them did in various projects. But we also tried to get other international organizations, not necessarily human rights organizations, to also help us in the actual on-the-ground training, information, education programs that we were trying to set up. We used a conference which was held in December of 1992 to try to bring together possible donors, international human rights organizations, other international NGOs, as well as the local human rights groups, in a conference which would look at the current human rights situation, think about where we want to go from here, look at specific projects which could be held in Cambodia, look at the role of local NGOs, and then look at the role of international NGOs and donors, and try to set up a series of projects, which is what we did in the spring of 1993. And many of those projects lasted well beyond the tax mandate.
And did you, after you were working in headquarters, so to speak, did you have adequate funding? Did you think that your funding for the human rights program in Cambodia was adequate?
Well, I mean, with human rights, again, the mandate is so broad and the situation was so severe that we could have done with, you know, hundreds of more people and billions of dollars more money. So it's very difficult to say. I think we had some problems at the beginning. I think our staff was probably, even by anyone's estimates, too small to do the work that we were trying to do. We didn't have enough people in all the different provincial capitals until well within the operation. But probably, given that we were only there for a couple of years, once we were fully deployed, and once we did bring on board a number of consultants and people through donations that we, extra donations that we had gotten from government, we probably had an adequate number of people to try to do the limited sort of things that we were trying to do at that time.
What, if any, restraints did you feel that you were under in pursuing human rights objectives, either from the attack organization or from the government?
Well, I think, you know, on the one hand, as people trying to promote and protect human rights and looking at the very broad mandate we had, we wanted to do, you know, sort of everything and anything, especially when we're faced with such a terrible human rights situation, especially in the run-up to the election. On the other hand, I think we all saw ourselves as part of a bigger operation, an operation which was committed not centrally to improving human rights, but committed centrally to a number of other things, including the holding of free and fair elections and repatriating refugees and removing Cambodia, so to speak, as an international source of tension and conflict. So I think we were always mindful of that. I think what that meant was that we geared a lot of our human rights work towards those political and civil rights which we thought were most important in terms of holding a free and fair election, and trying to work with other components as much as possible. But of course, on the other hand, as I said before, as human rights people, we also wanted to take a much longer term view. So in a way, our immediate sort of efforts in terms of a human rights investigation, setting up the Special Prosecutor's Office, recommending the redress, was aimed towards complementing the election effort. On the other hand, the work that we did in terms of, as well as information education coming, on the other hand, the work that we did with local NGOs and trying to set up these projects and bringing international NGOs on board was part of a much longer term strategy that we had. I think we looked at the resources we had, we looked at the time frame we had, and we decided that we could only make a tiny impact. We would try to link that tiny impact to the elections effort. On the other hand, we were there as the UN at that time. There was a lot of international attention on Cambodia. The best thing we could do for the long term was try to empower local Cambodians and local Cambodian human rights workers, and also to provide them with the international links and the regional links, which would not only fund their efforts in the future, but also provide them with a degree of protection once we left. So we wanted to set them up within a certain network to protect their efforts after we left as well.
Having said all that, though, did you feel that you were under any restraints as to what you could not?
I don't think we were under restraints in the sense of being told or being, you know, that we couldn't investigate this or that. I mean, I don't remember any situation in which there was a case which was too politically sensitive that we couldn't look into it or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I think it was always a case of redoing an objective investigation of whatever we thought was important, and then we worked it into the system. And then it was up to not just our company, but other components in Mr. Akashi to decide what the appropriate redress was and to calculate what the effects of pushing a particular redress action would be on other parts of the operation. And at times we were frustrated that the sort of redress actions that we wanted to take didn't happen. But it was never the case that we weren't able to, as a component, investigate or do other things that we wanted to do within the university.
A good many of the external NGOs, at least, were critical of the human rights work in Cambodia. I think that probably is the area that was most subject to criticism. Why do you think this is the case? What was the basis?
Of their criticism. I don't think it was so much a criticism of the component. I think it was more criticism that the UN in general, the operation in general, didn't do more to create a better human rights environment in the run up to the election. I think, though, again, given the time frame that we had, we meaning UNTAC as a whole, and the limited resources, it would have been very difficult to do much more. I think that, you know, obviously we could have taken stronger action. I think we could have used our power to dismiss officials much earlier and much more widely. Perhaps a special prosecutor's office or something like that could have been set up earlier. I mean, there were things that we could have done, and perhaps that would have marginally moved things in the right direction. But I don't think we would have had anything like genuinely, or we wouldn't have had an environment that we were all happy with for election, even if all those things were done. I mean, in a year or a year and a half, there's no way that you could take a country in Cambodia's situation and change it completely. I think that was obvious to everyone then, and is obvious to people now. I would say that in a way, the criticism shouldn't be that we didn't do enough or UNTAC didn't do enough to, within the framework of the mission, to do more to improve human rights. I think it should be a much more general criticism of not just UNTAC, but the way in which the whole peace agreement and the setting up of the mission was structured. In the sense that the whole thing was so focused on elections and the form of the election, rather than trying to improve people's lives, both in terms of their ability to exercise basic political and civil rights, as well as other things, as part of a much longer-term project of sort of democratizing the country, or trying to build stable democracy in that country. If you see what I mean, I think there was much too much focus, again, not just by UNTAC, but in general, in everyone's approach, on holding elections a year after an international operation was deployed, which then, as we've all seen now in hindsight, didn't really lead to a lasting democracy, rather than concentrating on a much wider effort to create the foundations for a better government, which might have meant, for example, a lot more emphasis on reconstruction and aid. And for instance, that link between human rights and reconstruction was never anything that was really, I think, thought through before the operation was set up. I think in the future, if there is any kind of operation like this, there needs to be much more attention given to what within a year we can actually do to change the society, given that our impact is always going to be very minimal anyway, rather than simply having elections and then leaving and hope that those structures that we set up after the elections are going to be.
I want to ask a question now in a rather specialized field of human rights, and that is concerning the peacekeeping forces themselves that were there.
Yeah.
To what extent, first of all, were you aware of violations of local human rights by the UN?
Yeah.
And to what extent did you have any responsibility
for
dealing with this?
Yeah. we were occasionally aware, because we would get reports, like anybody else got reports, of assaults on local people by UN peacekeeping, UN soldiers and things like that. It became a problem, I think, towards by the beginning of 1993, when there were enough of these cases that it was also in the press. But we weren't in charge of investigating that. A special office was set up to look into that.
Within the military?
Within the military, and then there was also something called the Community Relations Office or something like that. I would be surprised if any of those cases were ever dealt with in a very satisfactory way, for the people who were victims of any sort of criminal action by UN soldiers. But again, we were specifically not involved in investigating it.
Would you think that one of the lessons that emerges from that experience, though, is that there should be some kind of human rights training given to peacekeeping groups?
Yes, except I would still be very skeptical about the extent to which a week or a two-week course would really change things. With the UN police, for example, we would give these human rights speeches. But again, you know, it's helpful, and I think it should be done. But again, I don't think that would eliminate the problem in the way that perhaps much stricter or more severe punishments for those who violate these rights might.
Does the selection of the nationality of the troops make a difference in this respect?
It might. Obviously, if troops are from countries where there are all these severe human rights violations by the military of those countries against their own people, that you would expect that those troops would behave very well in somebody else's country either. But I think even troops from you know, well-established democracies who have a good track record are also capable of acting in pretty bad ways, and we've seen that in a number of other examples. So again, I think there are certain things that one can do preventatively, as you said, in perhaps giving some human rights training and selecting people better. But in the end, I don't think there's any substitute for once some sort of violation takes place, that person is then properly punished, and that people see that this person is properly punished. I don't think there's any substitute for that.
Did the evidence of some violations on the part of the UN personnel itself, did that in any way impede your work?
To some extent, though I don't think it was so widespread that it sort of impacted on the legitimacy of what we were trying to do, perhaps in a very specific place, but not in general spotlight.
I think one of the criticisms that has been leveled, it's not exactly in the human rights field, but I think it's relevant.
Yeah.
And that is, especially the NGOs were trying to do this, the disparity between the standard of living, so to speak, of the UN personnel,
yeah,
the rather luxurious equipment they brought in and so forth, and the local standard of living,
yeah,
led to a rather egregious comparison.
Yeah.
Did this affect your work? Did you find this was an impediment, really, to the kind of institution building that you were trying?
I think it could have been a problem, especially in Phnom Penh, when there was such a large foreign population. I think that was probably less so in the provinces. I mean, our human rights officers in the provinces often lived in very modest accommodation, and many of them were very sensitive to the context in which they were working. But I think at a more general level, I think when we go into countries such as Cambodia, which are obviously in such a poor state, and we're trying to really affect a certain amount of social change in that country through human rights actions or whatever, and then leave behind some sort of stable, more democratic government, we have to take into account the net impact over 18 months or 2 years of a multi-billion dollar foreign presence in that country. I think, on the one hand, it had a very, despite the income disparity and despite the misbehavior and the criminal actions of some in the operation, I think they had one very positive impact. I think, given that the country was so closed under the Khmer Rouge and under the Vietnamese occupation, I think the mere presence of a huge number of foreigners helped to crack open that society, or at least destabilize a lot of the more repressive institutions in that society. So in that way, that was a very positive impact, just simply having a huge number of foreigners running around and doing whatever they wanted to do. From a human rights perspective, I think, again, helped to weaken the very controlling mechanisms that the people in charge have had. Obviously, on the negative side, there were problems in terms of creating a bubble economy, which then left, as well as much more specific cases of exploitation and other things resulting from a big disparity.
Now, you were in this center, so to speak, but I judge the people from the field came in.
Yes.
You were familiar with them.
Yes.
And their attitudes. In Namibia, it's quite extraordinary, I think, the degree of enthusiasm and idealism that was evident and that remained in the both the volunteer and the staff personnel that were there in the field doing the human rights the work. What was the case in Cambodia with the people in the field working in human rights? Were they optimistic? Were they disillusioned? How would you characterize their
morale? I think the vast majority of people in our component were very committed. I think we all felt at least that we were trying to do the right thing and trying to move things in the right direction. The agreements themselves were fairly good, and that the structure in which we were working was all right. I think where the frustration was 6 months into our work, 9 months into our work, rather than seeing an improved human rights environment, we were seeing mounting political violence. And the last several months of our work up until the election was very much taken up by this problem. And that colored everything else that we did. All our energy was focused on trying to think of ways to stem this rising tide of political violence. And so, of course, that sort of dampened people's enthusiasm in general, or optimism in general, about what kind of Cambodia we would leave behind once the elections were finished and UNTAC withdrew. I think on the ground, a lot of our provincial human rights officers would have seen some improvements. Again, I think anyone who takes a slightly longer-term view of Cambodia and knew what Cambodia was like a few years before UNTAC arrived would have felt in those few months that UNTAC was fully deployed that it was a genuinely freer society. But I don't think any of us felt that it was going to be very easy for any of these human rights groups or democratic institutions that we had set up to survive once UNTAC had left. So there was also this sense of pessimism, especially in the last few months.
And what about the attitude of SOC? To what extent did the officials interfere with your work, discourage the people in the field, actually interfere with their work?
I think that in the very beginning, no one was quite sure what the other was supposed to do. I think whether it was SOC or the Khmer Rouge or the other factions or UNTAC itself, we were all unclear of our exact how much power we had and what the parameters we had in which we were working. And so I think early on, everyone was very sort of hesitant and sort of feeling around to see exactly what the other was capable of. I think that was the case with SOC. I think SOC was unsure how much power UNTAC really had, how much they could resist UNTAC, how much they could, whether UNTAC was bluffing, whether it was actually capable of doing certain things. I think once, several months into the operation, though, I think SOC became increasingly emboldened as it committed certain human rights violations, and there wasn't a strong response. I think that then led them to conclude that they could get away with various things, and they carried on. I think in the beginning, though, there was a feeling of uncertainty. I think perhaps if we had acted more strongly in the beginning and exploited that uncertainty, we would have gotten away with more than we did in terms of trying to change the state of Cambodia government apparatus. But then we didn't have a specific mandate for that, and that was the problem. When in a way, the mandate didn't include two things which probably would have been very important. One is to actually identify and dismantle repressive structures of government. And on the other hand, as we've had in Bosnia more recently, a mandate to arrest war criminals. I mean, that's a different issue. It has to do more with Khmer Rouge and people in the state of Cambodia government. But on the first thing, I think that was really key. So because we didn't have a mandate to actually identify and dismantle repressive institutions, we were in the end we were always reacting to the actions of those institutions rather than taking a more proactive stand. At most, we could have dismissed people in those institutions, but the institutions themselves would have stayed there anyway. So we were weakened in that way. We were always reacting rather than actually going in and trying to change things in a more permanent way.
Is one to conclude from that the actual rate of human rights violations did not decrease in the presence of the United Nations?
It's difficult. I mean, it depends how you sort of quantify these things. What increased was the number of political attacks by the state of Cambodia against perceived political opponents in the run-up to the elections. And that increased from January up until the elections took place in May. In terms of respect for other human rights, it's very difficult to know. I mean, because UN human rights run the whole sort of spectrum from education and healthcare and everything else all the way through to security process. And we didn't know what the starting base was. We didn't have a clear picture of what was there. I think people had the general feeling, as I said before, that the simple presence of a huge operation there and the work that we did in education and information did improve things. But again, I think it's impossible to quantify any meaningful way.
The reason I ask the question is it's interesting to compare the effect in different operations.
Yeah.
And in the case of El Salvador, for example,
yeah,
where ONUSAL set up a human rights monitoring,
yes,
team.
Yeah.
The mere presence of that team seemed to have a very salubrious effect.
Mm.
And the rate of human rights violations declined precipitously. You had a bigger presence, a bigger UN presence in Cambodia.
Yes.
But I judge you would not say that the effect, the mere effect of the presence of...
Well, I don't know the Salvador operation very well. I think a difference might be in that in Cambodia case, you had, in effect, a very repressive, authoritarian government which was in power in Phnom Penh and which controlled the vast majority of the countryside. Before UNTAC was deployed, that government allowed no political opposition within its territory whatsoever. During the period of UNTAC's deployment, political opposition was allowed, and then eventually there was a reaction to that. So if you count both the extent to which political opposition was allowed and was allowed to voice itself and organize, and the extent to which political parties were allowed to set themselves up in Phnom Penh to contest the elections, and then balance that with the extent to which then there was violence against these, then it's hard to say, was there an improvement or was there not? I think that at least by the time we left, there was an improvement in the sense that there were more or less free and fair elections, and you had a huge number of political parties on the ground, and people had access and had heard these political parties in person or on television. But again, it's hard to compare with the situation a year before, where there was less political violence in these areas, but then again, there was no organized political opposition whatsoever. The organized political opposition being on the battlefield in more peripheral parts of the country.
Now, we talked a little bit about the military. Certainly in Mr. Akashi's view, one of the weakest elements of this operation most fitful. I would think, as an outsider, that they would have been the closest allies, so to speak, of the human rights operation. How did that work?
Yeah, they should have been, and I think that's how it was conceived, that the police, because they were, I don't know how many of them were together, 2,000 or 3,000 civilian police, whereas we were 30 human rights officers, that they would be our eyes and ears, and they would be the people on the ground everywhere, and we would work very closely with them in monitoring, if not in actual redress actions. In practice, because the quality of the police that we were working with was so mixed, and the human rights knowledge or experience of nearly all of them was close to negligible, that it was very difficult to do that. I think that was a fundamental problem in the way that the whole operation was conceived and set up. I don't think I can think of very few countries, if any, where there would be a sizable number of policemen who could be like that in the UN, who had human rights, an adequate understanding of human rights promotion and protection. So the idea that you could have police to do that, I think, is highly problematic, and that